SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
About 20 minutes into hour two, after a really pleasant and special visit from Mark Gassie, the sole human electee from the polling that produced two contemporary Hall of Famers with Wise Dan and Mark. And Jay Privman of the Daily Racing Form joins us, and Jay is intricately involved in the process, actually, as part of the selection committee and more. And Jay, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. It's the nominating committee. I don't select them. We have a nominating committee to put them on the ballot. Just want to clarify that.
Well, and the selection process comes with the there's also the historic review group, and because I saw, you know, a lot of people seemingly were conflating everything that goes on, when the announcements come. Let's talk, Jay, about your impressions of how things turned out in this go round.
Well, just for what you alluded to, it is sort of a bifurcated process. There's the contemporary ballot, which, as you mentioned, that's the thing that I'm part of the process on, in terms of with about 15 other people coming up with the, this year there were 11 combination of trainers, jockey, and horses that were put on the final ballot. Two of those 11 got in. Trainer Mark Gassie and the horse Wise Dan. And then there's committees that chose the historic review inductees, one of whom was Daryl McHarg. And then there's another committee that chooses the pillars of the turf, and that was what included Alice Chandler, for instance. So that's the... So the conflating, I think, may have been done over, how did Daryl McHarg get in and not Corey Nakatani? Well, it's two different processes
that
happened in that regard. And again, all that's explained. If you want to read accurate information on all of that, please read the story I wrote in Daily Racing Form. It's all laid out, the whole process, how it happens. But anyway, getting back to the ballot, Steve, obviously, the two who got in are deserving. I thought we had put together a strong lineup, and there were more on there that should have gone in. And there's, a couple of personal favorites of mine, most specifically Kona Gold, that I just find mind-boggling that the electorate doesn't feel as strongly as the nominating committee, which had a majority of people put him on there, that he doesn't get the wider support from the overall voters. And I'd love if there's one of your contributors or a voter out there who did not vote for him, I would love to hear their perspective on your show as to why they think specifically Kona Gold didn't do enough during his 5 years on the track and multiple track records and buyer figures of 115 or higher 10 times. Five straight appearances in the Breeders' Cup, including a win, including an Eclipse Award. What was there that's not quite world-class deserving of being in the Hall of Fame? I don't get it.
No. And, the rise to the rise to success, specifically in the Breeders' Cup, has always struck me, from, you know, his third in his first go around to the second behind Artax, when he ran a 1:23 buyer, and then the win. And I was lucky enough to be there for the win at Churchill. That was a wonderful Breeders' Cup. And you know, Jay, you've heard me say this. I think you and I have discussed it, even going back to Alex Solis's induction into the Hall. I'm just always confused how people looked at Alex Solis and voted him in, and when looking at his body of work and his best mounts, looked at Kona Gold the same year and didn't put him in. It was just stupefying.
Well, you know, again, I don't understand how Kona Gold's, you know, not in. I'm glad Alex got in. Speaking of Alex Solis and Kona Gold, you know, that Breeders' Cup win, that was Alex's first Breeders' Cup win.
His first.
When
yep.
he won on Kona Gold. And going back to that Artex Breeders' Cup the previous year at Gulfstream that you mentioned, when he got the career best of 1:23 and still lost. it took a track record from Artax to beat him, and Kona Gold ran faster than the track record at the time as well. Just he was second best. It was kind of like Sham finishing second Secretariat. It's the second fastest Derby at the time, but you know, you lose anyway. But he was, you know, it was a great performance, and he came back the next year and set a track record at Churchill when he won that Breeders' Cup sprint. He also set a track record at Santa Anita in the El Conejo, and just multiple wins. I think part of the problem, Steve, I was talking about this with Jay Hubdy yesterday. For horses like Kona Gold, and I remember this kind of happened with Best Pal, it's almost like geldings get penalized for being forced to stick around. And, you know, people look at their overall record and like, oh, Kona Gold, he was 14 for 30. But, you know, his last couple of years, he wasn't at the top of his game. He was still very good. He obviously was good enough to run in the Breeders' Cup, in 2002, before his final year at age 8 in 2003, when he went 1 for 4. But, you know, they stick around because they have to. And to me, you know, I'm glad Wise Dan was recognized, and he had obviously a brilliant career and deserved to go into the Hall of Fame, and I'm glad he got in. But it's almost like a lot of times horses who, geldings, you know, specifically, who aren't quite as good at 7 or 8, they're almost like penalized. And I think you need to look at, you know, their overall body of work, and especially when they were really good, and sort of look at what that would have been like if they'd have been entire horses and maybe had left the stage at their peak. You might look at them a little bit differently. But the fact they stick around, and in a lot of cases, and in the case of Kona Gold, still do well, you know, that should not be held against them. I think it should be a badge of honor. So I don't know. Again, I would love to hear if there's somebody in your listening audience who is a Hall of Fame voter who did not vote for Hall of Fame. I'd love to hear their logic on, you know, what he fails to measure up on in their mind.
Now, I you know, listening and then looking at you know, the times that he didn't win, you know, who beat him, and it's a who's who of his era's, you know, best sprinters, including you know, into 2001, when he, you know, he would eventually end up, you know, going 2 for his last 9, give or take, swept overboard, Squirtle Squirt, who, of course, broke Bobby Frankel's frustrating over in the Breeders' Cup, Delaware Township, Orientate won the 2002 at Arlington, Son of a Pistol, who was a running son of a gun, Artax, and Big Jag, and Re-Raise. I mean, I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get it. I mean, that you mentioned the buyers, and I know that, you know, that doesn't mean much to certain kinds of people. However, you know, starting with the win in the El Conejo in 99, 115, 115, 115, 115, 123, 112, 109, 119, 118, 117, 114, 112, 119. Jay, I don't know if there how many horses in the Beyer era put together a string of efforts like that.
I would dare say nobody. You know, like I said,
that's what I think.
115 or higher 10 times, yet 110 or higher 17 times. 110 or higher 17 times. But, you know, not a Hall of Famer. It's just mind-boggling to me that he's... And this is not the first time he's been on the ballot. He's been on before. And
several times.
Hasn't made it. And I just don't... I don't get it. And the thing is, the ballot, it's a straight up or down vote. You're not restricted as to how many you can vote for. Like I said, there were 11 on the final ballot between the horses, jockey, and trainers. And you can vote for as many or as few as you want. So it's not like you got to go, well, I can only pick Mark Cassie. I like him best. So, you know, so I can't vote for Clement or O'Neill or Whiteley. No, you could vote for all, whoever, as many as you think are deserving. You know, and in the case of Whiteley, you know, I just think because he's from an era before trainers had 200 horses and before the Breeders' Cup, that I think people have trouble evaluating what he did, but he was a truly great trainer, and he will get into the Hall of Fame. This was his last year on the contemporary ballot. He'll now go to the Historic Review Committee, and while I'm not on that committee, I would be shocked if 2 years from now, when the Historic Review Committee next meets, because they alternate every year with the Steeplechase Committee, I would make David Whiteley 1-9 to be a 2022 Historic Review choice for the Hall of Fame. Truly great trainer, and another one who you're just like, what do people not get?
It was discussed last year, of course. Corey Nakatani, certainly Jay seems to have a resume that stands up with a lot of his contemporaries, and
or better.
I'm not sure what's keeping him out, or better. Yeah. How many Breeders' Cup?
I think what holds him back for some people is probably that he, he never won a Triple Crown race. But his Breeders' Cup record is exemplary. It's one of the all-time best in terms of number of wins and the range of kinds of races that he won. And obviously he had a great career in Southern California in terms of, the quality of the races that he won and the quality of the people that he rode against for three decades. He's the second all-time rider at Del Mar in stakes wins. Second. he's in the top 10 at Santa Anita in stakes wins and overall wins. And, think of all the riders that have ridden at Santa Anita over, since it opened on Christmas Day in 1934. And he's in the top 10. He had a great career. There's no question about that. So, there's just a lot of things about the voting that I don't get. I'm biased because I'm on a committee that put forth the finalists for the ballot. And obviously the ones who get on the ballot are all adjudged by the committee as being worthy of being on that ballot. We wouldn't put them on there if we didn't think they had a strong chance of getting in. So not that they all deserve to get in. I didn't vote for all of them because there's a few either I think need to do more or didn't do enough. But there more than two should have gotten in.
Very fair. And for those that, that aren't don't have the Nakatani record at the ready. The record includes 10 Breeders' Cup victories, including four sprints, which arguably is, you know, one of the most frenetic and you know, fraught events in the Breeders' Cup, that and the mile, you know, where traffic or hesitant start, you know, cost you. Think about Henny Hughes. But he won Elite de Justice, Jewel Princess, Elmhurst, and Re-Raise. He won the 99 mile on Cilic, won the Juvenile Fillies with Sweet Catamine, won the sprint also later with Thor's Echo from the rail when the rail was hot that day at Churchill. And My Miss Aurelia, I forgot actually that he rode My Miss Aurelia to the Juvenile Filly win in 2011. Regally Ready, Turf Sprint, and Tapizar, the Dirt Mile. 10 Breeders' Cup wins for Cenac.
And you have to remember his first Breeders' Cups that he competed in, and his first win, which came back in 96, that was in the, you know, an era before the card was expanded to what it is now. So there's more opportunities for Breeders' Cup wins over the last, you know, like 20 years than there were the first 8 or 9 years that Corey rode in Breeders' Cup races, when it was just a standalone card of one day, and there wasn't even, when he first was riding in the Breeders' Cup, there wasn't even a filly and mare turf race yet. So, you know, when you look at opportunities as well, it's you know, he certainly won. I mean, it, you know, those races and just so many other big races from coast to coast, ranging from, you know, the Beverly D to the Canadian International. You know, I mean, I could go through a whole laundry list of what he won. You know, Kentucky Oaks, obviously. You know, he won that twice. I know he never won the Derby or the Preakness or the Belmont, but, you know, a couple of Oaks wins will certainly notable. Anyway,
I'm gonna make a point, Jay, actually. When it comes to the Derbies, I mean, it's Derbies are mercurial, obviously, and you know, the rhyme and reason for Hall of Fame type riders, you know, winning Derbies is, you know, it's, I mean, Javier Castellanos looking for one, for instance, but Nakatani, I'm just looking at the list. He's actually had 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. He's had 8 top 10 finishes from what looks to be about 16 rides. And it's not as if he was on beaten favorites. I mean, Anise, right? Anise was favored that, right? In that year, in 2000? No, maybe not. Food Peg. You know, it's not like he had, you know, a lot of top choices that he was riding. He finished second on Nero in 2011.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they definitely outran their odds. But again, I just think that's, you know, one of the things that I think people have to realize when you're looking at a Hall of Fame ballot, it's different from the Eclipse Award. You're looking at a body of work. And that, you know, it's the body of work. What did this person accomplish, or has this person accomplished in the totality of their career? Not what did they do, you know, the last 2 years. And that's, you know, so, you know, for the human people on the ballot, that's what you have to look at. And I think the body of work here is pretty significant.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And, you know, some of the other top horses he's associated with, Lava Man, Sand Pit, Sarafan. Interesting.
I mean, yeah, and you can go back all the way
to Deputy Commander.
Serena Song. I mean, you know, it's not like it was
Serena
just a couple
Song.
Of years.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking 25, yeah. 30 years of, you know, yeah, top-level competition and success.
Quick thoughts about some of the other horses, Jay, that didn't tally. Blind Luck, I really think the world of, and I think she's got real merit. A little bit more than Rags to Riches and Havre de Grace for me. Game on Dude, first year of eligibility too.
Yeah, no, game on, dude. He's the only three-time winner of the Santa Anita Handicap. So you could, you know, there's, and won him, you know, multiple grade one races over his career. And another horse who's probably, you know, like Kona Gold, being penalized for being a gelding. And, you know, he was 1-for-5 his last year on the racetrack. You take that away, and he's 15-for-29 lifetime. Which is, and again, multiple grade one wins. So only horse to win the breeder, the Santa Anita Handicap three times. Those are significant things. He had 8 grade one wins. At the time, he was only the second horse to win the Santa Anita Handicap, the Hollywood Gold Cup, and the Pacific Classic the same year. The only horse who'd done it previously is another Hall of Famer, that being Lava Man. So, you know, he's got, you know, 3 big caps, the Goodwood Stakes, which is now the Awesome Again, the Hollywood Gold Cup twice, Awesome Again, Pacific Classic. Those are giant races. And, you know, over a long period of time. So you can make a case for him, certainly. You know, Rags to Riches is an interesting debate because her year was great and unprecedented. Kentucky Oaks win and obviously the Belmont win. But it was a brief career, and I think that's the thing people, the voters apparently are wrestling with is how to frame that. You know, what she did on the day of winning the Belmont and, you know, beating a Preakness winner in Curlin, who went on to be a, you know, a great 2-time horse of the year, and then and prior to that winning the Kentucky Oaks. I mean, that was a sensational streak. Those 5 weeks, and, you know, preceded by a couple of other grade one wins at Santa Anita and the Las Virginas and the Santa Anita Oaks, neither of which are grade one anymore. But, you know, she was like a comet. And I think that's what is probably hurting her, in terms of her support. And, you know, I like rewarding, and look, it's no fault of her. She got hurt and she had to be retired. But I think you need to admire horses like Game on Dude or Kona Gold or Best Pal or those types that stick around and are at a sustained level of excellence for multiple campaigns. That to me is a much more difficult thing to do.
Well, we'll see how the votes give everybody just a peek, Jay. Do you look at how the votes turned out in bringing horses back the next year when it comes to the nominating committee?
So everybody who makes the final ballot is considered by the nominating committee again for the next year. And, you know, some people's opinions may change over time. I mean, we've seen, obviously, people or horses who are on the ballot for, you know, several years who finally get in. And so obviously the overall electorate reevaluates things, and, you know, up or down. And for those on the nominating committee, I'm sure there are many who reevaluate, you know, and it's especially true with people who are still actively racing, either as trainers or jockeys. You know, you're continuing to reevaluate what that person or those people have accomplished. And so, you know, next year, to your specific question, for instance, the 9 who didn't get in this year will all be considered anew by the nominating committee to go back on the ballot. Doesn't mean they'll all get back on, because there'll be a revote, and then we'll see actually the 8 who didn't get in, because Whiteley goes to the Historic Review Committee. So the other 8 would all be considered anew. But then there'll be new people who are now eligible, who have been either riding for 20 years through the end of this year, or whose training careers began 25 years through the end of this year, who would be eligible to go onto the ballot and would be put forward, and also horses who have been retired for 5 calendar years by the end of this year would become eligible as well. And I would have to do some research as to who those specific instances would apply to, but there'll certainly be some horses, trainers or jockeys who would be newly eligible, and we'll see what kind of support they get to go on the ballot.
We also, of course, after talking to Brian Bouye on Wednesday, uncertain about the ceremony, but we'll know at some point going in toward the summer. They don't; they're not going to do any kind of a virtual, even if they have to just wait until next year and put in a two-day ceremony. Jay, let's shift from a. From the Hall of Fame conversation, which we have every year, and it's always some people might say, it's not that important. I always think it's a conversation worth having.
So I love the historical aspect of the sport as well as the gambling aspect of the sport. So I enjoy this kind of stuff. I think it's a great way also for people who might not be familiar with a David Whiteley, for instance, to maybe go back and educate themselves as to, well, why are people talking about him? Why was this guy on the ballot? I didn't get interested in racing until after this guy retired in 1995. What's the big deal? And you can look up what his record was and who he trained and what he accomplished and go like, wow, for a guy who only was training 25 horses at a time, not 200 like a lot of trainers do these days. That's pretty remarkable what he did. And even going back with the historic review, I mean, I didn't know anything about, I'm not on that committee, so when they announced who had gotten in, I mean, obviously I covered Darrell McHarg, but I didn't know anything about the Tom Bowling, the horse from the 1870s, and so it was fun to just look up what he had done. I enjoy that stuff as part of just the reporting process. So I would hope for fans, it's an interesting way and a fun way to educate yourself. And Lord knows we've got plenty of extra time these days, so why not?
Well, just for maybe another another fortnight, and then things are going to start to gear up. I don't know if you had a chance, Jay, this week. You know, I've had these Derby memory shows based on the date and going back in history, and Don Brumfield joined me yesterday, and Bill Boland going all the way back to 1950, which was crazy with the Middle Ground.
And
there is a funny, today being May 8th, people will say, well, if it was the first Saturday, how can there be races? Well, as it happens, not only were there three derbies on May 8th, the three of them are incredibly meaningful. War Admiral won his derby on May 8th. 1920, they ran it on the 8th when Man of War didn't come and really never even considered coming. And Paul Jones won it. And the first May 8th derby was Regret in 1915. And so here's only three times May 8th, and all really significant years in the game's history and in Derby history.
Yeah, no, it became, it's been run on the first Saturday in May every year since 1945 until this year.
Unbelievable. Well, Jay, let's talk about horses that will run, are hoping to run on the first Saturday in September. Yes. As always, very helpful, postscript analysis from you and the expanded chart comments. Your Arkansas Derby thoughts.
Well, the race got split. Charleston's certainly living a charmed life because if the race hadn't gotten split, he was in danger of not even being able to run. And then when it was split, they split horses by ownership and then by trainer into different division. That's blindly done. And I would say the first division came up easier in terms of depth than it looked like the second division did, both on paper and then I think the way the race has played out. But Charlton's a brilliant horse, and he set fast pace and kept on going and won. His fractions were slightly faster than the Nadal split race, where Wells Bayou had carved out the first six furlongs or so. But that race came home, the Charleston race came home slightly slower. But, you know, pace makes the race. To me, both performances were equally good in their own right. The thing I liked about what Nadal did is his previous race, because of where he was drawn in the Rebel, he had to go, and he got hounded early by a couple of horses who ended up getting beat a pole. And then he had another horse make a run at him late, and, you know, he really had no business winning the race the way it unfolded, and he still gutted it out. And then last Saturday, he just got a much more advantageous situation where he was able to sit just outside another horse and then go on with it from there. And that, from a tactical standpoint, certainly is it's a better place to be. And so I think, you know, his trip was a little bit, quote-unquote, easier last Saturday than it was in the Rebel, and yet he won both races. He's just a really, really good horse, as is Charleston. And I'm interested in just seeing how these horses progress. Still, the race is still 4 months away. They're both going to run, I'm sure, a couple more times before then. We'll have more time to evaluate. But they're both high class, undefeated horses, and they're certainly. Right now, they're Nadal on. I do the Derby Watch with Marty McGee, and we put him in. We decide on who our 20 are, and then they go in the order in which Marty's future line is. And he, after last weekend, made Nadal the slight favorite at 7-2 over co-second choice to Charleston and Tis the Lot 4-1. But the fact that there's three horses at 7-2, 4-1, 4-1 shows you how crowded it is at the top in both his and our minds in terms of the favoritism for this race. That's pretty much splitting hairs between, you know, those two different prices and amongst those three horses.
Some other thoughts down the chart.
I thought King Guillermo ran a really good race. I mean, as you know, I didn't know where his last race came from in the Tampa Bay Derby, but he had trained brilliantly since then, according to Mike Welsh at Gulfstream, and I thought he ran a really good race chasing Nadal. I mean, he couldn't catch him, but it was a strong performance in his own right, and so that to me really franked the form of what he did in the Tampa Bay Derby. He is legitimately good. Really wondering if the Tampa Bay Derby had been a fluke, but he came back and ran another really, really good race. I thought a horse who ran kind of a sneaky good race was Farmington Road in that second division of the Arkansas Derby. He's just not quite good enough to make an impact late, but he made a really long extended run into a pretty significant pace, and he was gaining ground for like the last 5/8 of the race while making this long extended run. It wasn't like he made a run, sat on him and ran it and then finished anew or sat on him all the way to the quarter pole and then unleashed him. He was asked or started gaining pretty far out and just made this long sustained run. And that's really hard to do at a high level. So I thought that was kind of a deceptively good race for a lightly raced horse who on pedigree figures to get better with more racing. So I'm really interested to see how he progresses over his next couple of starts. So those were some of the takeaways for me from that day.
Well, Jay, right now we know that the Matt Wynn is going to be run, and next 2 weeks from tomorrow, the 23rd, and ideally the Santa Anita Derby, assuming the okay comes, everybody waiting, and I'm sure on pins and needles waiting for the health department okay for Santa Anita to restart. Just 10-4-2-1 on points for the Matt Wynn, and I did see the comments from Brett Calhoun, who's plotting what to do with Mr. Big News, and I was a little surprised too that Churchill didn't give a few more points. But what were your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I thought they might have made it, you know, maybe 20 to the winner or something, you know, a little more than 10. I was surprised. I mean, could have been, but you know, look, they didn't feel maybe this far out it was worthy of that. So they didn't do the home cooking. So there's something perhaps noble about that as well. You know, you could look at it that way, a race that's still 3.5 months in front of the Derby. If this was the first Saturday in May Derby, a race that far out from Derby Day wouldn't have excessive points as well. So I think if you look at it through that level of integrity, then maybe that's where they went. You'd have to obviously get somebody from Churchill to comment on why they did that. But I was surprised, but if you look at it from the standpoint of a race that far out, normally that would not have been part of the, you know, that obviously would not have normally been part of the Derby prep schedule. A race that's that far out, though, on the old schedule would carry that kind of a point value. You know, it's different from the Santa Anita Derby, which was never run, has been postponed, and should still, you know, carry the point value that it was going to have initially, as would, I would hope, something like the Bluegrass. You know, if I know Keeneland wants to get some late summer dates, and if they do and they can slot the Bluegrass or its equivalent, then I would think it would retain the value of points that it would have had initially. But you know, Churchill Downs is a tough spot to be in right now, because as you were mentioning, you know, Santa Anita hopes to run but still does not have the official yet, and hopefully that'll come down the pike today. But you know, we're past due and thought they would have gotten the green light. Golden Gate got the green light yesterday, so that was good news for part of the state. But you know, New York's not back up and running, and there's obviously going to be some significant races there that could be included. You know, they couldn't run the Wood, and not that they're going to run the Wood, but whatever they decide to do with some of their other races for 3-year-olds that are coming up to and including something like the Belmont. I mean, those are all things that potentially could be point scoring races. And until these tracks have more concrete dates and stake schedules, you know, Churchill can't be just sort of, they have nothing to go on to in terms of the extra point scoring races that they've said they're going to add. Because there's just not a lot of concrete information right now is in a lot of places. So I'm sure as soon as things get more known in terms of NYRA or Santa Anita or all of Southern California, et cetera, then Churchill Downs will be able to move forward with an updated point scoring list. So they have to be in a holding pattern. There's no choice right now.
I know, and you know, you wrote about the holding pattern, and I was really struck in that piece, Jay, that virtually nothing has changed since you addressed it at the end. I think after the Florida Derby, I mean, it literally is we're in the same exact spot. I mean, except with the little, you know, the obviously Churchill being able to start running is a help, and you know, it gives us an overall, you know, some. You know, something to look forward to, but I'm a little surprised at you know, the middle part of the country. I mean, there's, you know, for those that would have thought, you know, the Iowa Derby, the Indiana Derby, Ohio, none of those venues have anything other than speculative start dates in terms of, you know, getting going again. So. You know, Churchill's on their heels a little bit in terms of, you know, where they go next. So, yeah.
Right, in terms of Derby point scoring races, I mean, they at least can get back up and going. But, yeah, there's nothing that they can't do anything really until, like you say, these other places come back online.
Unbelievable. Well, in the meantime, Jay, we, you and Marty keeping tabs on horses like Maxfield, and I mentioned Major Fed earlier, Marty writing about the prospective Matt Winfield. You've been keeping track as well on Tis the Law, and you spoke to Barkley this week. So, you know, everybody else that has got some points in the bank, they're just you know, keeping them healthy and happy and on treadmills.
Yeah, that's he said. Barkley said we're just treading water. You know, they're just he's keeping the horse fit and just waiting to see. You know, he'd like to be back up in New York. He would be in New York by now.
Yeah,
and I think once they can reopen and once they can lay out a stake schedule, I think that's where you'll see. Tis the Law focuses. Focus his attention. He's obviously a New York bred, Saratoga Stables, obviously something at Saratoga would be ideal for him. But, until those things get ironed out, they're just down at Palm Meadows waiting to see what transpires.
Jay Pribman, I appreciate it as always, and quiet weekend to say the least. Quietest probably ever at this time of year. And next week, though, there'll be a few more venues on everybody's ADW screen, and I think the train is going to start to pull out of the station next week.
Yeah, let's hope so. You know, it's funny though. Even though it is a quiet week in terms of maybe the purse values or that grass race tomorrow at Gulfstream is unbelievable.
That's really good.
It's a $75,000 race. It could be worth 10 times as much. That's an unbelievable field for the shows. There's no place to go right now, and these horses are ready to run. They got to go. But that's some field for $75,000.
We're going to talk to Mike Welch about it in a little bit. And I actually, when we come back, I spoke before you came on. I was on the phone with Mike Lakow and talking about some of the way the schedule came together for that card tomorrow, because people saw those maiden races early on and the way the turf races were scheduled and why there were so many dirt there originally when they put this card together Wednesday, the forecast was for late afternoon rain. And so they wanted to make sure not to have any, dangling participles late in the card, They didn't want to be put in that position to say, oh, we're taking off the 11th race off the turf. So Mike was protecting everybody's wagering interests by setting things up the way he did.
Very good.
So I wanted to get that in there. Jay, thanks so much, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Jay Pribman, everybody, DRF Pribman, Derby Watch, along with Marty McGee. Let's take a break, top of the hour, and Rick Hammerly going to join us next, see what Hammer's been up to. He was out, he found an open hiking trail. He was beside himself the other day. if you followed that on Twitter, he felt like a conquistador marching into unknown lands. Mike Welch, as I mentioned, as well this hour. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Warned the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust. It's not tax dollars. And by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.